The Guardian.
I think of fire in connection with emotions, because when you become stirred up, when your emotions control your actions, it affects not only yourself, but the people around you.
Hello and welcome to A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Daniel Glaser. And I am a neuroscientist, or at least I used to be. I'm also director of Science Gallery London, which is going to open soon, opposite the Shard in London, as part of King's College.
Psychologists find that control of emotions can be gained by understanding the stimulus-response pattern. When you have certain experiences, you respond with various emotions.
For just over 2 years, I wrote a weekly column for The Observer magazine, and in it I explored the world of culture and topical events seen through a neuroscientific lens. And in the second season of this podcast, we're revisiting some of those columns and exploring the neuroscience within. And this week, we'll be talking whooping, emotions, and how the two can interact.
I think in terms of the basic emotions, we are definitely just standing on Darwin's shoulders. He really said a lot of stuff. You read the book, you think, well, this is extraordinary. The whole idea about how you interpret these experiences and what meaning you put on that is why people, you know, for the past 50 years have got very interested in cognitive therapies for emotional disorders or emotional problems.
And as you all know by now, each episode begins with a single conversation.
So this podcast, as we say, we're revisiting
between me,
highlights from the articles I wrote for The Observer magazine,
and producer Max.
The back catalogue.
Back catalogue. And I'm a little bit excited, Max, because when you... So Max very kindly prints out what it was I wrote, because there were 130 of them. And I saw this one and it put a big smile on my face. I remember we discussed doing it and I read it. And I thought, oh, this is really good. I'm really looking forward to this one. And then Max said, oh, I'm not looking forward to the World Cup this year. I probably shouldn't say that, should they? Because you're going to be doing brilliant pod work on the World Cup.
I won't, thank God.
So the World Cup football soccer is in 2018, later this year, which I've completely forgotten about. This column, Max, goes back to 2016. And apparently, according to the second paragraph, it was the final of the European Cup Euro 2016 that was that day.
Between who?
I've no idea.
Nor do I.
But what the piece was about clearly not me or you, Max, but people who like soccer, and there are sports I do like whooping for joy. The headline was how whooping increases your enjoyment.
Just if people don't understand what whooping is, give us a whoop.
I'm going to break your microphone. I'm going to turn away and then whoop.
Lovely.
Although that was more kind of I'm about to be run over kind of whoop, but that's kind of whoop.
Yeah, that's a roller coaster whoop.
It's a roller coaster whoop. It's a whoop is an audible expostulation, generally signifying joy.
So what was that word, Dan?
Expostulation.
Ooh, that's beautiful.
Thanks, man. And the piece is really about what it's like to express your emotions, Max, which, you know, of course, we should all be doing more as we get in touch with ourselves, and in particular in the context of the sports. And I'm going to sound horribly smug, so you'll forgive me, Max. Don't know if Podwell will. I read the last paragraph. I thought, oh, that was good, because I'd forgotten writing it. And the thought experiment was contrasting two people watching a, sake of argument, football match, which they're excited about. Someone scores a goal. One person is doing this, let's say, at home, you know, in their apartment. So they're on their own on the sofa, but, you know, kind of average evening at home. And the other is watching, as we increasingly can, Max, in the library, you know, on their phone with some headphones, OK? Now, the person at home, when the goal is scored, is likely to go, yes, you know, jump off the sofa and woo. And generally speaking, the person in the library won't. And the thought experiment for this week, Max, is what is the difference between celebrating a goal while jumping up and down and whooping versus celebrating a goal while being in a library, being still, being quiet and not moving violently.
And this taps into one of my favourite subjects from my neuroscience degree, emotions, and how emotions are produced and how we feel emotions. And if I remember correctly, I remember getting taught this, and there were various sort of theories of where emotions came from. And one of my favourite came from a guy called William James. He was, what, around the end of the 19th?
I'm saying end of 19th, beginning of 20th century.
And he...
Who was his brother?
Who was his brother?
Yeah.
Henry James?
Yeah.
Right, well, 10 points. Yeah. And he, I don't think it was him, I think it was him and another scientist at different times came up with this theory, which was essentially that emotions were a response. The emotions we felt were a response to our physiological state. So instead of seeing a bear and being scared and therefore the physiological response is happening after you had that state of being scared, it was you saw a bear, your body responded, and then that created fear. And I remember getting taught that and I was like, oh, I really like that. And then our lecturer was like, yeah, but it's completely rubbish. And then they moved on to the next one, which was some sort of thing driven by behaviorism whereby, you know, emotions are created in your head and then your body responds. And then I left uni, kind of forgot about it. And then I was doing another podcast about emotions and speaking to a researcher called Lisa Feldman Barrett. And she basically told me about her new theory, which I think is gaining a lot of traction now, which was more similar to William James' theory. And I thought, well, that's brilliant.
And I guess the two things that, I mean, I like in what you're saying. Firstly, you know, the cyclical nature of the way that science and neuroscience work. But the other thing that's interesting, and I think this will be interesting to listeners, and is interesting to me as we kind of, Max, I think in this case, do try to find out this week what's, you know, latest knowledge, latest stuff on this, is just to set out some basic stuff that we can kind of almost know from introspection. And as you know, Max, I'm not at all fond of introspection. I think introspection is a really lousy way of finding out what's going on inside your head. But here are some things that I do know. So one is I got really freaked out during my undergraduate degree and walked out of my first finals exam about a third of the way in, which I don't recommend, actually. Is a pretty scary thing to do. And obviously freaked out quite a lot. And I was talking to someone to help me out. We all need help sometimes. And he sent me off to my GP, to my family doctor, and he gave me beta blockers. Mm. Now, beta blockers is a drug which stops you from getting adrenaline rushes, basically. It just blocks the pathway.
Mm.
And one of the interesting things I noticed was that because I wasn't getting those kind of butterflies rushes, I wasn't as nervous, right? But clearly the beta block, well, not clearly, but the beta blockers don't affect your brain. They just stop your heart from beating faster.
Mm.
But the fact that my heart wasn't beating faster every time I thought about the next exam meant that I wasn't as nervous. And so I guess the thing which seems to be true about the expression of emotions, the way that your body behaves when you emote, is that, and here's the thing I think that's critical, that the emotions that you feel are not just expressed by your body, but are somehow synthesized, constructed by your body. Now, it can't quite be the case that it's all about the body, because you can read a book and get excited. I mean, you know, like if you're about to be run over by a truck, you could kind of imagine that some very basic brain systems are causing the fear and you're not really thinking it through and your body knows before you do and all that kind of stuff. But if you read an incredibly beautiful poem that makes you cry, there's clearly some very sophisticated processing going on in your head. So it is starting in your head for the most part, but it very rapidly kind of loops out into your body and then back into your head. And Max, I think what we need to look into this week is these loops between the brain and the body that constitute the expression of and the feeling of emotion. Perception. And to explore these loops, I looped back into my own past on a university campus in central London. And luckily, I found exactly who I was looking for.
My name's Sophie Scott, and I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London.
And we're talking to you today as a scientist, but Max... Sophie's probably best known for her groundbreaking work into laughter and nonverbal communication. You should definitely search for it online if you haven't already.
As it were, Professor Sophie rather than stand-up Sophie.
But I started by asking her for a simple definition, which turned out not to be all that simple after all.
It's probably not one thing. Some of what we call emotion is kind of states of being that have got evolutionarily older histories than us. You find in other mammals. So things like fear and anger, laughter, probably reflect things that play different functional roles in the lives of mammals, which have an effect that's not entirely down to pure communication. You know, they have bodily changes, they tend to be situational, they tend to have particular behaviours associated with them. And then emotion can take you all the way through to, like, a, you know, your feeling of being you in your skin and how that is for you that day. So today and yesterday, I've had two really nice days.
I was saying to Max, I've had a very nice day as well.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit brighter and you sort of feel spring coming and looking forward to Easter. And there's a sort of an emotional tone to the day, which without being a specific emotion is just a more positive or negative feeling. So, and that still gets called emotion. Probably, it's probably an example of a word that is not very well operationalised in our field because we use the same word to describe a lot of different things. We use emotion to describe things going wrong in a, you know, in a mental health context as well. So it's not clear to me always that we exactly mean the same thing by it. There's always some implication of valence to it. It's good or it's bad. And there's some implication of it being more than just a fact, like that I'm feeling good, I'm feeling bad. You actually feel good or you feel bad. It goes beyond some piece of formalised knowledge and becomes, for want of a better phrase, embodied in some way.
Indeed. And I should say, Max, for those of you who, unlike me and Sophie and Max, are not in this room, Sophie's using her body to talk about what emotion is quite a lot. And I think we'll come back to that embodied notion.
Yeah.
And indeed, there are people using their bodies outside in the corridor, which is kind of fine that happens. And just to kind of get to compare it with other domains. So we're here at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience in UCL. There are professors of other things here. Are the professors of other bits of neuroscience or cognitive neuroscience clearer on what it is they study than you are? Right? Because your definition of emotion was quite laboured and exampled and ended up with it being continuum and a thing you're not quite sure of. But if I were to ask one of your colleagues what they do, are there other things which people do which we understand better what it is than emotion?
Probably anything. When you start chipping away at the edge of it, it becomes pretty hard to define for sure with humans. But I think, for example, Neil Burgess and colleagues do all that beautiful work on space representation, and I think that's something with very clearly operationalized edges and points where they say that, you know, because they're looking at cells responding in different situations to different navigational aspects of environments. So, you know, it's not always the case that things have got messy edges. And you could probably find something within emotion, a specific topic within emotion, and find that that's got very clearly defined parameters. I think it's the word emotion that becomes harder to nail down.
So if you've come here looking for clean edges to our emotions, you'll probably be disappointed. But messy is fun, right? And after this short break, we'll muddy the waters even more by digging into the science behind our own emotions, including the role a racing heart can play.
The early sort of experimental psychology studies with emotions were things like injecting people with adrenaline and then putting them in different situations, because the same signal, a racing heart, could be interpreted in two different ways depending on other things that are going on.
We'll also explore a lesser known role emotions can play for each and every one of us.
Because it's taking us out of just this individual model of emotion and saying actually where it really is powerful is when you can use this stuff together to make things better, for example.
We'll be right back.
Hi, Charlie Phillips here.
Hello.
Our latest episode of The Story is a new idea from the documentaries team here at The Guardian, which we've called DocTales. Each episode will take our latest film and explore the people behind or within it. Whether it's the filmmakers or their subjects, we delve into the stories behind the story. And to celebrate our latest film, How to Make a Pearl, we hear from filmmaker Jason Hanasek about his subject John, who lives his life in the dark.
He describes when he has had too much light, he will burn.
What I live on here, I have a feeling of hope that I will get out of here, but that feeling of hope also carries me. If I don't get out, you know, I don't get out.
And I think that that's what pearling is to bring things that are stuck really way down deep to make something beautiful so that those can come back up, so to bring the grit from just being this.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Story on your favourite podcast app. And to watch the film, head over to theguardian.com/documentaries.
Well,
Welcome back to A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Daniel Glazer. Before the break, we were talking emotions. And specifically, how hard it is to pin down a definition. Something neuroscientist Sophie Scott knows all too well.
So, like, as it were, the history of emotions. So, as it were, a brief historical digression. So I'm talking now the history of, as it were...
I also spoke a little with producer Max in the studio about some theories of emotion, which included the mention of a certain William James.
You know, was it thought of as a different thing than it is thought of now? How do people used to theorise or think about what emotion was in the old days?
It is interesting because if you look at, as a science, it took us quite a long time to start asking questions about ourselves in a scientific way. But you can see emotion. I mean, William James would talk a lot about, you know, his own mood when he was introspecting in a way that would kind of lead him into thoughts about psychology. So I think it's been quite profoundly important. And another great theoretician, Charles Darwin, he basically said everything that we're still finding to be completely correct about the basic emotions back in his book on the expression of emotions in man and other animals. And in fact, if anything, he got some things right there that we forgot about for years and then we kind of had to rediscover, like with laughter. So I think in many ways it's there from the outset. Even, you know, the ancient Greeks had ideas about, in as much as they had kind of ideas about the science of human behaviour, there's quite a strong role for emotion in that. So I think emotions are very accessible. We're not always right about them, but they feel like things that we, because we can experience them and we experience them so vividly, because if they're not vivid, they're not really an emotion, that they then feel like they are something we've got a handle on.
So because of this, a whole range of theories of emotion, including those from Darwin, have popped up throughout the field's short academic history. And it's here that we come to the role the body might play. When it comes to emotion. Something known as embodiment.
I think it's probably fair to say that we don't entirely understand this, but if you go back to the ancient Greeks, the reason why the ancient Greeks thought that the brain didn't have much to do with anything is because you experienced emotions in your body. There is a sort of somaticization, it's called. If you think about that kind of awful, panicky sensation of fear, or a kind of horrible dropping sensation that something's wrong, or the kind of, you know, that pulling feel of grief. And actually, there's a guy, Lauri Nieminen, in Finland, who's done really beautiful body mapping studies. People are very consistent about where they feel emotions in the body. It's really very, it's not random.
So the fact that it's not random is one thing, but if I were to find, you know, I don't know what, if I were to take some measurement of physiology, so maybe it's electrodes or maybe it's acid, pH or, you know, whatever. So I find the bit of the body which is associated with a particular emotion and I find some objective measure of what's going on with it. Is there actually something going on in my tummy when I feel an emotion that I project onto my tummy?
I think we don't know enough about stomachs. Well, I know people are starting to look at this.
But it's easy. Your stomach, because you pointed at yours. Just
yes, yeah, yeah. But you definitely get it in the heart.
Okay.
So one of the reasons why, if you've ever had medication that's made your heart race or your heart slow down, your emotional reaction can be quite strange to that, depending on how you interpret it, but it's because there's a link between it. So one of the things that's thrilling or terrifying about being wildly in love or absolutely awfully prolapsed with fear is that both of those could be associated with your heart rate increasing, and you might interpret it differently. You will interpret it differently based on other stuff that's going on, but one of the experience of that is your heart behaving differently. So almost certainly there would be other changes going on if we can get good ways of measuring them. For all I know, other people have.
So when I was at college,
unbeknownst to Sophie, I've experienced exactly that.
Somebody sent me to the GP, and the GP...
Cast your mind back to my chat with producer Max and the beta blockers I took to help me with my exam nerves.
As I was, although as it were, I want to say, tell me if this is right, I want to say my brain was the same.
Turns out, Sophie knows this feeling all too well.
Exactly. I mean, I did something very similar. That's how I passed my driving test. I failed my driving test twice by driving through red traffic lights in a state of absolute panic.
Yeah.
And I took my brother's beta blockers and passed it. And my driving instructor said afterwards, what were you on? What were you taking? Because it's the same thing. I would get into a panic and then it feeds back, the heart race, and then you... Because it's not just that you experience these signals and then get into an emotional state. You get this kind of, it's called appraisal and feedback. So you can, it can kind of worsen because you react to the fear, and then that makes it, you know, your heart speed up again, and it's not, you know, that you can, that's how you can end up in a really bad place.
So it's a loop, isn't it? Because yeah. So it's the fact that you're about to do an exam is not like a massive buffalo running towards you, right? That's something that starts solely in your head. Mm. It's very, you know, cognitive and very symbolic. It's Tuesday, it's coming up for 11 o'clock, lots of detailed knowledge. That then makes you scared, which gets your heart racing. And then your brain comes back into the loop, noticing that your heart's racing and gets you to feel scared. Is it as simple as that?
It's probably going to... Nothing's ever simple with humans, but there's certainly one of the early original...
Nothing's ever simple with humans.
The early sort of experimental psychology studies with emotions were things like injecting people with adrenaline and then putting them in different situations, because the same signal, a racing heart, could be interpreted in two different ways depending on other things that are going on. But if your interpretation is one associated with fear, then you're going to react to that with fear, and then it's just going to get worse and worse. So it's the beta block in that context is helping you, even though you might still be mentally getting panicked, your heart isn't kicking in to match it, so you can't get completely caught up in that loop. The whole idea about how you interpret these experiences and what meaning you put on that is why people, you know, over the past 50 years have got very interested in cognitive therapies for emotional disorders or emotional problems, just helping you reframe that. Okay, just because I feel this doesn't necessarily mean that that's a bad thing, or in fact this would be the best way for me to react to it. So actually changing the brain level cognitions around it can be an attempt to again break that cycle in the same way without using drugs.
So, you know, what is the human mind is so fantastic about, and what, you know, just I find is just awesome, absolutely awesome, is that in a quarter of a second we can build a whole range of scenarios.
Well, that's a rather simplified suggestion of a complex mental process, but you get the idea.
Based on our judgments about other people's intentions and other people's perception of the physical environment that they are in. And we do this completely automatically.
Something interfering with our behavior, our action.
Without the slightest bit of thinking about it. And any brain that can do this is pretty fantastic, I think. And that's really the human brain.
And the emotional response to love is usually the result of a show of affection or favors. And these seem to be the emotions with which we start life.
So all of the, what do you call them, you know, scientists that I like, as opposed to ones that I don't, have this broad historical reference, right? So when you're talking about this stuff, Sophie, it's as much, you know, William James and Darwin and so on. But I wonder, I don't mean to say, are we making progress? Because actually what you said is interesting, that we're actually going back, we're rediscovering things that were true then. But is it the case that there is, you know, this big new theory of emotion or this killer experiment that we're approaching that can kind of reduce it in some way or make progress? Or are we just sort of, with emotion studies or whatever, is, you know, embellishing a tale that was begun by Darwin? Or the Greeks even.
I think in terms of the basic emotions, we are definitely just standing on Darwin's shoulders. He really said a lot of stuff. You read the book, you think, well, this is extraordinary. And we've rediscovered or demonstrated empirically that he was right about a lot of stuff. I think that the discoveries in the cognitive revolution in the 60s and 70s, that there was not this independence of cognition and emotion, that the two were so tightly linked that you could actually affect emotional states by addressing cognition, that was huge. And again, you can tinker around the edges with that, and people have done, but that's massive. I think for me, what's really changing now is we're starting to get a very good feeling for the fact that we're not doing this stuff in isolation, that actually there is something, there's this beautiful data coming out of Robert Levinson's lab about how it's all very heteronormative work with married couples, but probably applies to all friendships and all close relationships, looking at how people navigate stressful situations. And what he finds is if they do so with what he calls positive affect, but he means things like laughter and smiling, that actually is a way of negotiating an improvement in everybody's mood, but only if you both do it. You have to sort of work a way of doing it together. And that's very interesting because it suggests we're not just signalling our state at each other, but actually when you're with the people with whom you have some kind of emotional connection, you can actually navigate your way to an improvement in your mood together by using emotions in an interaction. And I think that's really interesting because it's taking us out of just this individual model of emotion and saying actually where it really is powerful is when you can use this stuff together to make things better, for example.
So that's a nice insight for those of you who may be told off for trying to make light of a bad situation. Next time, blame it on evolution. So I think I know what Sophie's answer might be for this week's column. 10 points. But best to make sure.
The thought was that if you're watching European Cup on your own, so this wasn't about social emotion, but you're on your own in your apartment and a goal is scored, you go, yeah, and you jump up. Now imagine you're in the library and you're watching it on your phone with headphones and you're sufficiently self-aware that you don't jump up. So the goal is scored, but you have to continue to act like you're in a library. The question was, will the feeling of euphoria that arises from your team scoring a winning goal be different for you in the library because you can't stand up and whoop than it would be at home, right? Even though the stimulus is the same, is your emotion different because you've made your body do something different?
Well, I think the idea that this is a loop that you get into would suggest probably not, that you would need, you know, they would certainly help. I think
it's not the same.
It's not going to be the same, okay, I suspect. I mean, obviously other things would interact with it, but it is interesting that if we want to, you know, because we laugh more if there's somebody else with us, because we have a lot of evidence that the triumph way thing is, it drives the same orofacial mirror stuff that we get for laughter. So it's a prime, you know, it's primed by hearing other people do it. So probably that would be another good example of a contagious behaviour that could work. You'd just experience it more strongly in groups. And it is interesting. These are both things we like to get together with other people to do. I can see that it would be hard to actually... There could be other contextual things that would be affecting what's going on there. Maybe you'd be one of the ways that you might actually stop yourself from cheering in the first place might be consciously squishing that stuff before it even gets off the ground. So you may already be suppressing it. But it's definitely, certainly for social emotions like laughter and cheering, we do them a great deal more if there's other people around us. And I've certainly been in situations where I've been frightened by something when I was with somebody else that would not frighten me if I was on my own. So, you know, it's entirely possible that this is, you know, a much more widespread phenomenon.
So whether you're alone or in company, a good whoop can certainly help you feel better. Special thanks this week to Professor Sophie Scott. This episode of A Neuroscientist Explains was presented by me, Daniel Glazer, and the producer was Max Sanderson. We'd love to hear what you think, so please do send any thoughts, feedback, or neuroscience queries to aneuroexplains, all one word, @gmail.com. Well, I know I'm feeling a lot better. Bye for now.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.